I'd like to thank you all for coming, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak in this session. I'd like to cite the contributions of my collaborators. This was very much a team project. Linda Beniz, also from Johns Hopkins APL, and Jim Jing and Jerry Tokars at the CDC BioSense program, among others. As Ruth mentioned, my membership on the ISDS board, and on that board, one critical need I see is a need to address the disconnect between academic researchers in disease surveillance and public health practitioners. And one of the purposes of this grant was to address that. The outline of the presentation is to discuss the data environment we used for the study, which was Department of Defense outclinic visit records, a clustered detection methodology that we implemented based on the popular SAT scan, the synthetic signal approach, the design of the study, results of the study, and conclusions. It was a fairly complex data environment. We used 3 years of military clinic data from Texas, including 32 clinics actually within Texas and two bordering it with many Texas military personnel. The 32 clinics, you can see their distributions. The patient records included a field for the zip code of the clinic of treatment and the zip code of patient residence. In many cases, the resident zip code was where the their local one. In some cases, the resident zip code would be someplace out of state. The data were not distributed like the census population, which creates a problem when you're trying to decide what the distribution of cases should be. The cases were also not evenly distributed by zip code. In fact, they were highly skewed toward a few locations. You can see that these are both histograms showing median daily count and the number of facilities. And you could see that with the clinics, 20 of the 32 had a median daily count of zero. And most of them were concentrated in a few, while in the with the resident zip codes, 1,099 of the 1,233 had a median daily count of zero, with just a few. So this is a complex problem to a situation like SATscan, and one we tried to address. I'm going to briefly mention what the method of scan statistics. You move around these circles, it could also be ellipses, and you ask how unlikely are the cases within that circle, or you could make it a cylinder by including a few of the past days, and ask how unlikely are the cases in that cylinder relative to the rest of the population. You apply a statistic to each candidate cluster, and you ask which of these, whether it's a small one or a large one, whether it's over here, whether it's near the border, has the most unlikely value, and find the regions whose centroids are the base of the cylinder that has the most unlikely statistic. Having done that, you'll get one every day. The question is, do you care? Is this statistically significant? There's no place to look this up. So you have to do Monte Carlo trials. This is done in all the implementations I'm aware of, where you create many distributions with a similar expected distribution and ask how unusual is mine compared to all these. So that's the basic idea. We had our own implementation for a couple of reasons. One reason was to be sure we were right. We had separate codes developed in C and in MATLAB, and we precisely checked them down to the level of getting the same random number generator for both. This enabled us to test the spatial distribution estimation methods, because in this particular data set problem, it's difficult because you cannot use census populations. For significance testing, we used a paper by Abrams, Kulldorff, and Kleinman that lets you get a pretty good estimation of significance using much fewer replications. We only needed 100, and this let us do the repeated trials that we needed for our study. We also added a capability to inject parametric stochastic signals to background data in order to evaluate detection performance. And this, I think, was one of the main motivations. A number of people have mentioned the fact that we really don't know what outbreaks look like in real life, and with the spatial component, it makes it even harder. The details of our study was that we inferred our spatial distribution from a sliding baseline of 8 weeks with a two-day separation buffer. In this study, there were two estimation methods used for individual zip code totals. One was a flat baseline average over the 8 weeks, and the other one was averages stratified by whether by the individual day of week. In Jim Jing's presentation last year, he showed a number of other spatial estimation methods that we compared. This study just looked at these two. We only looked at single day clusters, and the output of the scan statistic were clusters whose p-values were below a threshold. We ran this scan statistics on the entire year, 3 years of data, to get the background daily rate, and injected sets of stochastic signals to measure detection performance. Now, what about this business of injecting signals? There are several approaches here. I've heard a couple of talks here about the need to understand what health events look like. Diane Matusak's talk mentioned the fact that you don't know exactly what the distribution is going to be like, how many cases you want to detect, and what we put into this module lets you put in a plausible event based on what you think you want to detect. The approaches are using purely authentic data, which is really difficult because there's so little known about outbreak effects with spatial distribution. Purely synthetic data, which most people just don't believe because it doesn't capture the real noise of the background data. And the semi-synthetic approach we applied here, where we injected realistic signals into authentic background data. So we added a fixed number of inject cases, and I'm about to say a little bit about how, 30 to 100 records region-wide over about 8 days. We ran the scan statistic detection on the resultant data set. Our criterion for detection was to find a statistically significant cluster containing a zip code with injected cases. And I don't think it is realistic to ever think that an analytic method will show you exactly where the outbreak is. That I don't think you can do. I don't think this method will ever tell you, here's an outbreak. What I think it will tell you to do is look in this region, look around here, this is around where you want to look, and this is about the extent, and then you can examine. I think it's unfair to expect more of the data than that. In subsequent trials, we advanced the start day by 8 days and repeated the process for 130 trials using about 3 years of data. This let us evenly sample the day of week and seasonal effects, so we would be biased that way. As far as our injects, for the region-wide epidemic curve, we used an old concept from Dr. Philip Sartwell at the Hopkins School of Public Health that's been widely used since then, where he found that whether a disease had an incubation of a couple of hours, like strep throat, or several months, such as types of hepatitis, the epic curve distribution tend to be log normal. So we did stochastic draws from a log normal curve, multiple draws like you see here. So each trial was one of these histograms, and you could get the number of new symptomatic cases each day, and then for each day we would spatially spread these cases among the zip codes. And so for each trial, we would compute the histogram of cases by day, then distribute each day's cases according to the geometry of spread. Several inject geometries were available in our module, and these were developed by Linda Meniz in a fairly sophisticated application for some other, for another project, and so you could either And the dots kind of show you, if you apply this circular geometry, what the distribution of zip code centroids would be. You can see the same for the wedge and the hourglass geometries. So, just to give you an idea of what the sample distributions would look like, the top one shows a resident zip code analysis. You can see that for the zip codes that got injects, you can see they had a fairly small amount of data, and the red numbers show the injected cases. This is just one example. But if you look at the region-wide, if you look at the region-wide column, you can see that there was 740 actual background cases in here, and we injected 50 over the course of a little over a week. We also projected these cases to the clinics where people would go for the clinic analysis, and this was based on our analysis of what clinics, how they drew people from their different home zip codes. So you see the similar plot down here, data with injects by facility zip. So you can see that it's a fairly large number of cases, and we're injecting something that would be hard to detect if you didn't have this spatial component. I have a couple of results charts. You can see that these comparisons can be done by, here you can see urban, suburban, or rural, where urban was taken to be a situation where it was pretty dense, you had a lot of background cases. Suburban would be somewhat less dense, and the rural would be out in zip codes that aren't near a clinic at all, would there be a fairly small number of cases. And you can see that having the residence level analysis gave us much better probability of detection. I should say that those numbers are sensitivity in the sense that they were the fraction of trials where we actually detected a significant cluster with injects. So we had, in the rural, we were perfect on almost all these studies, but for the suburban, somewhat less, for the urban, still less. Going down to the facility level, we lost some sensitivity. However, the facility one, it kind of depends on your public health objective. If you're interested in something that's going to happen around a base, then you probably want to do this facility level analysis. But if you want more general sensitivity, then you would want to use the resident zip codes that come out of the patient records. Did I show both of them? Can you go backwards here? Okay, Ruth, how am I doing for time?
You're doing fine. You have at least 10 minutes.
Good. Okay, this...
Use these arrows here.
Okay. So for the respiratory syndrome, we looked at 50 total added records and also 100 total added records. And clearly you do better when you have a larger outbreak to detect. But even for 50, we don't do terribly. The trouble with this respiratory syndrome was its noisiness. The fact that you also get a lot of background clusters that weren't relevant. And I think this had to do with the fact that the respiratory syndrome was so broad, that if you had looked at just ILI or a smaller sub-syndrome, you would do better. But in any case, you do pretty well with the sensitivity. For the rash syndrome, you actually have higher sensitivities because you have a less noisy data set. And in fact, I think this is a pretty good application. This syndrome lends itself very well to this type of analysis. Again, we did extremely well for the rural, but not so well for the urban, and less well for the urban or suburban. And for the public health practitioner, I think that there are several lessons learned here. And one has to do with what are your objectives? Do you want to detect something out in rural areas as well as in urban areas? And analysis like this also helps you set your p-value and gives you an idea of how large an event you might be able to detect. I've just put this slide in to show how much how many more cases you would need for a 90% detection capability and for a 75% detection capability by the third day and for the full event if you were looking at the state level. And at the state level, the time series are very large, and you would need many hundreds of cases to detect the full event at 90%. At the large facility level, you'd need a couple of hundred. At the small facility or residence level, and many of those have median zero, yes, you could detect just a few cases. On the other hand, you don't have people doing surveillance in all these little areas. So this presents an operations research problem of, given your distribution of monitors, what do you need to do? And given that there aren't many, you probably want to do something like these scan statistics. We also applied this to compare. I'm just trying to say that there are several applications of this methodology. Here, I mentioned the problem of estimating the spatial distribution. We use this flat baseline average. We use this weekend-weekday average with 100 injects and no injects. The top curves, the solid ones, suggest that the flat baseline average on the basis of estimated detection probability of our simulations suggests a more sensitive capability, but they also have a more, they also give you more clusters if nothing is injected. So when I drew this dotted line here showing that for similar background rates, you can see that with the weekend weekday stratification, you get a pretty significant you get a pretty significant advantage in detection capability. So I want to close with some summary remarks and some conclusions. One is on the utility of this signal formation and injection procedure. It allows you to do scenario-based comparison and tuning of cluster detection methods, so that you could make changes, look at different p-values, and see how well you're doing. Another one is to quantify the alerting capability. If you want to get use case specific, and I think that's where evaluation methods are going, to try to be more use case specific, the question is how large a signal is detectable? How do you set your thresholds and estimate spatial distribution for required sensitivity? Another one is clarifying sensitivity by the background density. We looked at this urban, suburban, rural to get an idea of in different subregions we're interested in, what sensitivity might we expect, and what background alert rates might we expect. Finally, helping to evaluate syndrome groupings for a clinical data source by quantifying spatial noise effects on detection capability. Now, I want to say this carefully because it has to do with the choice of syndrome groupings. And I think this is properly done by the epidemiologists who know what some syndromes they want to look at, what case definitions they want to look at. And I'm not suggesting that the statisticians should drive these choices. What I'm suggesting is that statistical analysis has a place at the table and should be considered in these things. If I'm going to apply this broad respiratory group in with this particular data source, what price am I going to pay in the false alarm rate? So I'm just saying that. No, I'm not saying the analysts should drive that decision, but I think they need a voice in that decision. A few conclusion slides for our outpatient visit data set. For the event-based scenarios involving the bases, you do want to use the facility-level cluster detection, although with that that first larger syndrome, it's not going to give you great sensitivity, but if you choose a smaller one, it can. And this was more representative of the work location. And there have been a number of papers written on the importance of getting the location of exposure and the difficulty of getting the location of exposure when you have these data. And there have been some papers on trying to solve that problem. Also, but for maximum general sensitivity, we found that it, as you saw from the results, you should use the residence level zip codes. To estimate the spatial distribution in a data source like this, and I'm afraid that in many of the data sets, the population, the patient population is not distributed like the census population, and any cluster detection method will succeed or fail on the basis of how well you estimate that distribution. It must account for day of week and seasonal effects to avoid spurious clustering, but if you overfit for a specific syndrome grouping, for example, when we took a really rare syndrome and tried to apply day of week modeling, you can actually lose specificity. So I don't think one model fits all, but I don't think that the analysis has to be that detailed. Second, specific to this data set, the rash category allowed the detection of small clusters. It says less than 50, but actually you could see like 30 additional region-wide cases in a week at pretty low background cluster rates, so this worked rather well. On the other hand, for the very broad respiratory syndrome, we found it too noisy for sensitivity to modest-sized clusters at low alert rates, and I would say consider a more specific filtering or sub-syndrome for this data set. The third one is that these findings emphasize the importance of really classifying records by location of exposure, but not being able to do that if you can at least say residence or work location. Also emphasizes the syndromic record filtering for effective signal-to-noise discrimination, and as I said, I think statistical methods should be considered. Lastly, and one point in deriving our implementations was with these idea of services. Could a service to do this be made available, let's say, over the grid? And in talking to state, county epidemiologists, yes, they'd like this capability, but it's a lot of work to develop. So if the service could not only find you the clusters, if the service could also display the clinics, the hospitals, the chief complaints, and other key record fields for all cases in suspected clusters, if they could identify potential record linkages among these records, then I think you'd have something. Then I think this kind of layered service is something that many state and local epidemiologists could use without a lot of investment. And that concludes my remarks. Are there any questions?
We actually have 15 minutes for questions, if there are any from the audience. Nikolai?
The answer is yes, and of the biosense syndromes, well, actually, I tried all 11, and I found that the rarest ones, like the severe illness, for that it wasn't helpful for, but for the other ones, like hemorrhagic illness and localized lesions, the results were quite similar to the ones for the rash. The broad GI one, again, tends to be too noisy. But I guess the answer is yes. And I showed those two because it showed like the noisiest one and a characteristic sparser one.
Are there any other questions? Yes.
Subpopulation data set. Are those classifications perhaps extendable towards non-military personnel, say the VA, data set that BioSense also has access to, or are those unique to the military nature of where DoD facilities are and where facilities are and where base housing?
Well, I'm going to give Linda a chance to address this, but the concept, I think, is definitely extendable. Jamie was talking about Seattle, King County, and certainly right around Seattle, you would be worried more about a false alarm rate if you had a cluster there. But when you start to go to the east where it's more mountainous, a cluster is probably a cluster, and you're more likely to have a serious concern if something should pop up there. Did you have anything to add on this? You're talking about the healthcare utilization again, which is going to be a much different situation in the civilian and maybe less problematic than it was when this data set, where we were all worried about how far people would commute out in Texas. But you're probably...
I guess I'm going with the classification of urban versus rural, which has a lot of baggage.
Okay. So the answer to your question is yes, it should be done, but it's a different problem. Okay, did you have something to add?
Our classifications for rural, urban, and suburban are basically how many people came to the clinic and the rate of utilization. So I think that could probably be extended very easily. And you probably see the same kind of thing, but with a little bit better correlation with the radius of travel.
Diane?
Howard, did you look at population density? Look at other stratifications, like data stratified by age or things like that, to see if it improves
protection? That's a really good question, because age is the thing we should have looked at. However, with the military, with this particular DoD data set, keep in mind that the children are going to be underrepresented. I would think around San Antonio, we would have a pretty decent sized retiree population. So for that reason, I think that would have been an important thing to do.
You know, the question about urban and rural triggered a thought in my mind. I've been working around health information exchange in the National Capital Area. And one of the things, I'm not living there, that I discovered is something that they call the Potomac Ocean. If you look at the Dartmouth atlases of where people seek hospital care, you know, there's no crossover from the district into Virginia or from the Virginia into the district. And they have very oddly shaped patterns of where people go for Medicare, health care, hospital-based health care utilization. So you have these new geometries of utilization layered over, you know, what we like to think of as cylinders and zip codes. So I realize that your study of military populations will be not an answer to the question that I have, and the question I have as a general one, is anyone kind of looking at the Dartmouth Atlas as a way of starting to define the geometries of care-seeking behavior?
Well, this man is. Peter Hicks, who asked the other question, and I think it's an outstanding suggestion, and it's something we need to implement.
Are there any other questions? If not, I want to thank you for participating. I want to thank our presenters. I want to remind you that you should complete your session evaluation.